Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame, die sich immer an die Regel hält. Deutschmarks or Dollars, American Express will do nicely, thank you. Heute mit der ersten Episode aus Los Angeles, Kalifornien. Als Berliner weiß ich natürlich, wie man eine etwas größere Stadt benutzt. Deswegen hatte ich in New York jetzt nicht so eine wahnsinnig große Akklimatisierungszeit nötig. Wenn man mal U8 gefahren ist in Berlin, dann hat man auch schon irgendwie alles gesehen. Mit der schieren Größe von Los Angeles hatte ich jetzt tatsächlich so nicht gerechnet, obwohl man das natürlich eigentlich weiß. Aber die Zeiten, die man braucht, um von A nach B zu kommen, wie viel Zeit man tatsächlich im Auto verbringt, wie in die Breite, in die Weite gezogen diese ganze Stadt ist, daran musste ich mich erstmal ein paar Tage gewöhnen. Es sind tatsächlich auch so ein bisschen so Ruhrgebiet-Vibes von den Entfernungen. Also wenn man von einer Ecke, von einer Seite der Stadt zur anderen fährt, ist es so, als ob man mal eben von Gelsenkirchen nach Bochum und dann von Bochum wieder zurück nach Köln und von Bottrop mal eben nach Düsseldorf fährt. Das sind schon Entfernungen, die man hier zurücklegt, wenn man einfach nur innerhalb der Stadt bleibt. Wegen eines blöden Zufalles habe ich dann am Anfang auch keinen Mietwagen bekommen, weil in meinem Pass und Ausweis mein Name mit Ü geschrieben wird, wie er halt geschrieben wird, und auf der Kreditkarte aber mit UE. Und man der Meinung war, das passt nicht überein, man kann mir diesen Wagen jetzt gerade nicht rausgeben. Das heißt, die ersten Tage habe ich LA tatsächlich mit Bus und Bahn kennengelernt, was total interessant war. Man sieht doch nochmal andere Sachen von der Stadt und trifft auf andere Menschen in der Stadt, als wenn man nur im Auto sitzt. Ich habe inzwischen ein Auto und das Fahren hier ist natürlich ein großer Teil des Vergnügens, weil man gibt bei Google Maps einfach irgendeine Strecke ein und fährt dann zufällig an Entrance zu den Paramount Filmstudios vorbei, ist plötzlich auf dem Mulholland Drive oder fährt an dem großen Beverly Hills Schild vorbei, das man aus 90210 kennt. Also es ist schon alles ziemlich iconic. Das ist zwar irgendwie ein sehr runtergenudelter Begriff, aber irgendwie trifft er auf L.A. zu. Was L.A. definitiv nicht ist, ist eine Theaterstadt im Gegensatz zu New York. Also natürlich gibt es Downtown, so das Amundsen oder die Disney Concert Hall. Im Amundsen laufen dann eher so Broadway-Shows, Broadway-Style-Shows, die hier auf Tour vorbeikommen. Disney Concert Hall habe ich zum Beispiel sowas gesehen wie ein Requiem von Rufus Wainwright. Um die Ecke der Disney Concert Hall ist das Red Cat, was ich vielleicht so vergleichen würde mit dem Hau Hebel am Ufer in Berlin, also so eine etwas experimentellere Venue. Und es gibt Downtown sehr, sehr viele leerstehende, in Anführungszeichen Broadway-Theater, also ziemlich große, ziemlich prächtige, leerstehende, runtergekommene Theater, wo es inzwischen so Bürgerinitiativen gibt, die wiederzubeleben. Ich hoffe, dass ich in einer der nächsten Folgen mit einem der Macher dieser Initiative sprechen kann, vielleicht auch eine kleine Führung bekomme durch diese leerstehenden Theater. Aber eine Theaterstadt ist es nicht. Wenn man viel mit dem Auto unterwegs ist, fällt einem mehr auf. Man sieht viel Drag-Shows und man sieht sehr, sehr viel kleine Comedy-Schuppen. Gibt natürlich so die ganz berühmten Comedy-Store und so weiter. Aber an jeder Ecke Comedy-Shows. Dass es alles so etwas theatral abseitiger ist, das macht es auf eine Art vielleicht auch interessanter, spannender. Man begibt sich tatsächlich hier so auf eine Suche. Meine Gesprächspartnerin heute ist Little Miss Hot Mess, Drag Queen, Professorin, Kuratorin, Kinderbuchautorin. Im One Institute in Los Angeles, beziehungsweise in der Galerie des One Institutes, gibt es zurzeit eine Ausstellung mit dem Titel It's Where I Belong, 40 Years and More of Drag in West Hollywood. Das One Institute ist eine der dienstältesten LGBTQ-Organisationen im Land. Ich glaube, es gibt sie seit 1952. Und Little Miss Hot Mess hat sich in die Archive begeben, Aufrufe gestartet und ganz viele Materialien zu 40 Jahren Drag in West Hollywood zusammengetragen und eben zu dieser wunderbaren Ausstellung zusammengeführt. In unserem Gespräch erzählt sie von ihrer Arbeit an der Ausstellung, an prägenden Persönlichkeiten und Organisationen, die in dieser Ausstellung vorkommen und die wichtig sind für die queere Geschichte West Hollywoods. Dann sprechen wir über ihre Arbeit bei der Drag Queen Story Hour, wo sie als Drag Queen Kindern Bücher vorliest. Das ist ein Projekt, das von den konservativen Kräften hier in Amerika gerade ständig angegriffen wird und davon ist sie auch ziemlich betroffen. Und schließlich berichtet sie mir noch ein bisschen über ihr Research-Projekt zu Drag und Digital Technologies. Wie könnte es anders sein in Kalifornien? Sehr spannend, also viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Little Miss Hot Mess. Maybe I start with the exhibition, which I saw, the super interesting exhibition. Can you tell me a little bit about it, how it came along and how you worked on it and what it's about, etc.?
So the exhibition, it's called It's Where I Belong, 40 Years and More of Drag in West Hollywood. And even before I got brought onto the project, it started as part of the City of West Hollywood's 40th anniversary celebrations. And so they have kind of surprisingly robust arts funding and put out, you know, a number of grant opportunities for cultural organizations to produce different types of exhibitions and programming for this celebration. And so the One Institute, which it happens to be the oldest continuously operating LGBTQ organization in the country, got this grant to mount an exhibition on the history of drag in the city. Really, the whole exhibition came together in like less than 4 months from when I started.
How did you work on it? Where did you do the research, and where did you collect all the materials?
I would say about half the materials came from institutional archives, and about roughly the other half came from community members. And so the One Institute has a sort of sister organization or partner with the One Archives at USC. I'll say, even though I'm an academic, I'm not really a historian by training. So I've kind of poked around in archives before, but I hadn't really done extensive archival research. And I was kind of focused more on finding materials that I thought would, you know, make for a good exhibition, which might be a little bit different than if I was trying to write a narrative history of drag in West Hollywood. I've sort of been saying that there was both more and less than I expected to find in the archives. You know, not surprisingly, drag as a kind of ephemeral subcultural art form is not something that tends to be institutionally archived in any kind of intentional, conscientious way. So, you know, when I got there, I think I expected there to be a few more collections that, you know, were from a specific drag performer, a specific venue, or you know, were kind of explicitly labeled as related to drag in some way. And so there were sort of fewer of those than I expected. But, you know, as soon as you start looking at, you know, photography collections that include, you know, pride parades or any kind of nightlife, quickly you're seeing a lot of drag queens emerge. So knowing that there was going to be this kind of limitations in the formal archives, I knew that I also wanted to reach out beyond them. But just from my own experience, you know, I know that people have often like incredibly interesting materials shoved in closets or, you know, in boxes under their beds or, you know, hanging on their fridge, like all sorts of things. And so that was exciting to just kind of put the call out and see what came back. And I did find that people were just really eager to share their stories and materials.
Ah, so you did actually like put a call out, ask people like, do you have stuff about this?
Yeah. Out on social media. I think some of the city agencies helped with it. And then I did some kind of targeted outreach to people who I knew, or, you know, and I did some kind of just light interviews, kind of getting a sense of who's still around. 40 years is sort of an interesting time. I think, you know, there's a lot of recent history, and going back 40 years isn't that far, but it's almost like too soon to seem historic to a lot of people. So I think sometimes just kind of reminding people of like what they might have is also kind of part of it.
What I found really touching when I was visiting the exhibition was that it's like, it almost functions as some kind of like memory shrine or something like this. Because people are like, there were a lot of people like older queer people like walking around and saying, oh, I remember this and I remember this, because a lot of the spaces don't exist anymore that are like documented through flyers or photos or something.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, in terms of the kind of presentation, you know, the centerpiece of the exhibition is this large photo wall that, you know, it's primarily photographs. There's some flyers and other materials on there. And I set it up to be kind of salon style. And I was thinking about that in the sort of vernacular of drag culture and nightlife venues. It still is on kind of like a white gallery wall, but I've been in so many drag clubs where there is some version of, like a wall of fame or, like you said, almost like a shrine or an altar to people who have come through. And so that was kind of the sort of visual that I had in mind. Rather than trying to fit it into like a neat timeline or chronology or to really get, deep into kind of thematic groupings, I kind of wanted this feeling of the messiness, the lack of categorization that I think, drag as an art inherently offers.
Are there some like performers who stand out?
RuPaul is certainly there, who I'm not sure has ever lived in West Hollywood, but I think has had a major presence here, even prior to the current television empire. There's a newspaper advertisement for one of her shows from the 90s, which is one of the few original archival pieces. And that's actually next to some pieces by Charles Pierce, who was located in, at least in Los Angeles. I'm actually not sure if she was in West Hollywood, but also kind of had a bit of a national reputation prior to, the drag media landscape that we have now. And yeah, I was known for doing a number of different impressions and things.
Because there was somebody in the crowd, I quickly talked to her, like also, oh, I think older, maybe drag performer, huge wig, huge.
One of the cheerleaders?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, she was also on one of the photos.
Probably Ida Slapter, who's a West Hollywood cheerleader. And yeah, I mean, the West Hollywood cheerleaders are also just an interesting group. I mean, they've been around since at least, I would say, the 80s or maybe early 90s. They're iconic in both in the drag sense, but also kind of in the literal sense, where like their outfits and things are so recognizable that like it became this kind of visual aspect of continuity across a range of different collections and photos and things like that. There's a large Carmen Miranda inspired costume. This was a piece. Her name was Delaya Deland, and she, I believe, wasn't like a professional drag performer. Like I think it was a little bit more of kind of a hobby, and in her day job, either worked in or owned like this pleating company. And so, the garment is like all handmade. It's like a million pleats. And like even the pineapple fruit hat, it's like all pleated, and the grapes are handmade, and like it's just like the level of detail is wild. And she was also like an activist and things. But the piece lived in someone's garage for many years and then was passed on to a younger queer like leather and costume designer who has also kind of been holding on to it and was like trying to figure out if there was a contemporary drag performer who might want it. And then when he saw this call, was like, this is the perfect place to display it. And I'm so happy because it is just this like incredible, larger than life archival garment. So that's really special. I will also say, a lot of my work is about drag queens, or kind of defaults to drag queens. And I did want to make sure in this exhibition that drag kings were included. And the title of the exhibition, It's Where I Belong, it's a reference to Chapel Roan's Pink Pony Club. And I think to like the spirit of West Hollywood is kind of seeing itself as this, space of belonging for queer and trans people. But I also wanted to sort of just like gently trouble that a little bit by acknowledging that the project of being welcoming is something that's always in progress, and a lot of drag kings, and also I would say like trans people of color have not always felt as welcome in the city of West Hollywood. And so in some ways being able to showcase that work disproportionately and also to kind of bring in some materials intentionally that are not from West Hollywood but are from other parts of LA was part of my process as well, just to kind of do some of that world building of like not reinventing history but like encouraging kind of forward motion to be more inclusive. So there's a couple costumes as well from some drag kings, Johnny Gentleman and Manny Oakley. You started by asking me about like key figures, and I honestly think Like the thing that still intrigues me the most are the people who I don't know who they are. I'd say probably 90% of the people depicted on the photo wall, maybe even more, I don't know who they are because again, you're lucky if in the archives, like there's a photographer and maybe a date associated with a photograph, but there's almost never like a list of who's depicted in the photograph or sometimes even where it's taken or things like that. And so there's, like a book called Cruising the Archives. And in some ways that's what I feel like I was doing, right? Like just sort of navigating through all these things. And but as you do that, like you do start to see these figures who pop up sometimes multiple times, either like different people's photos from the same pride parade or maybe like that same person at different events. And so yeah, if and when I have more time, kind of like figuring out who some of these mystery figures is important to me. But I think again, in the sort of curation of the show, like I wanted people to have those little murmurings or whisperings or conversations with the people they're with of like, oh, I remember that person, and kind of, yeah, letting them provoke whatever sorts of like memories and reminiscences they might
Have.
have, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, you are totally right that all the interesting part of drag is like you become your own key figure somehow, or you create your own, you become the star. So it doesn't care like whether you are doing it alone in front of your mirror or in front of some on a big stage or in front of a restroom door in a club. You are on the big fucking stage. You are the main, you become the main attraction. And also that's a little bit like how the material is presented in this exhibition. It's like a fan wall for everyone. It's like everybody's up there.
And I think a lot about I didn't get to like include this specifically in the exhibition, but the word legendary, which is something that gets thrown around a lot in drag parlance, and I mean, there's a way in which it's like sort of a superlative, like, oh, that person's legendary, that moment is legendary. But I think if you like kind of really nerd out on the usage of the word, it really it like it does speak to sort of a drag, like a collective sense of memory, right? Or like a collective sense of, yeah, of informal documentation of things where because we haven't been in formal archives, these things need to live in people's minds and like and become this mythology that often then is like not perfectly accurate, but it's larger than life. And it sort of gets shared in these like happenstance, nostalgic. I don't know. I think that there's something so kind of beautiful about that, that as much as I wish there was more material in the archive to work with, I'm also like, we still got it. We don't necessarily need everything to be documented perfectly. So.
I think I had Latin in school. Was legendary? Isn't it something like based on isn't legere something in Latin called like reading or being written down or something?
That's so
Something.
funny. Oh my God. Yeah, I've never taken Latin, but I co-wrote this piece about called Strategic Legibility, where we talk about the root of legible, which is legere for, and I did not put together that legible and legendary likely share that same root. And you're totally right, that sense of kind of like readability. Although, yeah, now I'll have to think about sort of how I would think about legendary.
Becoming readable. No, I don't know. But I never thought about it myself. I just, yeah, interesting. Do you have some like favorite objects in the exhibition or something that you found like researching, like that stood out or that you love especially?
I love that I was able to include a number of costumes, just to really help bring kind of like the material culture of drag into the space. Like, given how much drag is an ephemeral art form, it is also a deeply material one, right? Like, it's about costumes, it's about the makeup, it's about like adding all this material. And so I think being able to showcase that even in a relatively small gallery was something that felt important to me. And I should say too, even I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, I, for a completely separate project, proposed an exhibition on the material culture and sort of like the, I think I called it momentous. Like I was sort of thinking about like both the ephemerality, but also like almost the kind of monumentality of drag too, right? Like it is, it's larger than life and it is very tactile. And that never came to be, but I think that was so like still in the back of my mind in curating this show. I think another thing that I really love, there's this collection of pins from the Imperial Court of LA and Hollywood, which is like a 50 plus year old service organization, that does a lot of fundraising and activism in the community, and they every year elect an emperor and an empress to kind of lead the court. They create like pins and buttons both for campaigns, but also each court usually creates one at the end to commemorate their reign. And it's actually like kind of it's like both a parody, but also in that way that drag is also often sincere in its parody or in its satire. It draws kind of directly on like Russian monarchy and whatnot. So there's like all this just like interesting sort of weird anachronistic symbolism that gets put on these things. And part of what was special about that was like that was a set that was loaned by a community member who is kind of the historian of the Imperial Court. And yeah, I mean, like I literally went over to his apartment and he had them in these like almost like popcorn tins, you know, or like cookie tins. And so like we kind of just like dumped them all out and went through one by one with him trying to identify which ones were actually from LA and which ones were from other courts that he had collected. And I don't know, it felt very intimate and sweet and yeah, kind of just like the perfect example of those home archives that don't usually get to see the light of day, but yeah, I think are really deeply meaningful.
I remember those pieces you mentioned, and I was reading them and I was like, what kind of organization is this? Because they look, because you said like they were collected in those cookie tins, they look so real. I was like, which kind of embassy gave out those rules? What is it? It looks like a really
Right.
existing political organization or something.
Yes.
What is this?
Yeah. And I mean, like again, it is and it isn't. They're a, you know, a 501c3 organization. They've raised probably millions of dollars over their 50 plus years for various organizations. You know, there's chapters across the United States, Mexico, and Canada, and the LA. There used to be more in California, and they've sort of consolidated. And you know, there's like all these histories about how they consolidated and who was involved and when. But even yeah, the mythology of it was it was started in San Francisco by Jose Saria, who is kind of a luminary in drag history, who was inspired by this other eccentric figure in San Francisco, who had declared himself emperor of San Francisco, maybe like 100 years prior, maybe a little bit less. And Jose Saria, yeah, kind of like took this mythology and declared herself his long lost widow, and therefore the empress, and founded this, yeah, like incredibly long lasting organization. Yeah, and it's not something that I've ever been part of personally, but I've always admired the kind of like state pageantry of it.
I read somewhere on your website like the word of like that you are also interested in like queer play. Is
Yeah, absolutely.
that maybe an example of that? Like to play with something like existing rules or existing aesthetics or something and create something new, subversive maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of drag kind of generally as queer play, but I think you're right that there's many different ways in which that kind of plays out to be punny. Yeah, I mean, whether that's like playing dress up or, you know, playing some kind of fantasy or yeah, playing with these kind of dominant cultural forms.
I'm also interested in also a little bit always in like in the personal stories of the people I interview, like how did you get in contact with drag?
In some ways, I do feel like I always wanted to do drag even before I really knew what it was or that it had a name. I mean, I was that queer, effeminate child who, yeah, liked to dress up and play pretend in all sorts of ways. And also, I did theater and different types of performance as a kid. And I guess in high school is it, that's when I started to kind of understand what drag was, although I wasn't out or really like even, I don't know, just kind of not fully aware of my own sexuality or gender identity or anything. But I was just in some ways attracted to this art form. And I went to like a high school dance and drag with some friends once, and I was in a production of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, where all I wanted was to play the drag part in the play within a play. And so those were kind of like my early tastes. And then I would say in college, I started to, watch some of like the early drag films. Well, early, not early, but like 1990s drag films like Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And kind of, I think, then started to understand drag really as, rooted in queer and trans communities versus, I think prior to that, like I knew what a drag queen was, but I'd seen more like, cross-dressing on Saturday Night Live or kind of like more dominant, often straight cis kind of examples of cross-dressing where that, sometimes lean into the misogynist or the kind of homophobic tropes. And so, yeah, I think as I kind of came into my own queer identity and began studying some of these things a little more seriously, that's when I started to understand it as, an inherently queer and trans art form. And then after college, I moved to San Francisco, a little bit on a whim. I had never been there. I had some friends who were moving there, and I sort of knew it was this, queer beacon. And so I ended up there and yeah, started going out a lot more and watching drag. And prior to stepping into the identity of Little Miss Hot Mess, I was in a sort of drag retelling of the Harry Potter stories called Hogwarts Express the Musical, which was mostly with drag kings and like burlesque performers. So like mostly like dykes and trans guys. And I wasn't doing femme drag for that, but kind of through that, I really decided it was something I wanted to keep doing. And yeah, Little Miss Hot Mess was born.
Does Little Miss Hot Mess have a drag mother, or is she self-taught?
I both. I consider myself self-taught, but also taught by, a lot of aunties and drag family. I was adopted a few years into my drag career by another performer, Jordan Lamour, in San Francisco, who's been very kind to me. But I would say, like, traditionally, a drag mother is someone who puts you in drag or helps you get in drag for the first time. And some people have like very close relationships to their drag mothers or drag families. And that's not quite how we were, but she's been there at key moments, and I've always appreciated her for
I
that.
see. What is the hot mess part
Oh,
of the
that was a
mess?
name that I earned in my early 20s when I was first going out, and yeah, used to be a bit of a
It's
hot mess.
biographical.
It is biographical. Yes, that was actually, I was probably like 21, 22. I was at Pride in New York City with some friends, and yeah, just very sloppy and messy. And kind of everyone that night got like some kind of Little Miss name, like one friend in the group sort of was just making up these nicknames. And so I became Little Miss Hot Mess. And when I decided to do drag, I didn't have a drag name. And yeah, it felt like kind of the right thing. And I liked that it, I do love a punny drag name, but I kind of liked that it broke the mold a little bit of that format. And now I like to joke that like I've mellowed out. I'm less of a hot mess in practice these days, but I sort of like to, show the world what a hot mess it is. So, yeah.
And it is one.
And it certainly is fun, yeah.
Do you also do like this classic like club gigs, or do you more like art venues, or like on the intersection of like club and art and
You know, these days I haven't been performing as much in nightlife venues, period. Most of my time in drag these days is with Drag Story Hour. So it's sort of funny that like it's now tends to be earlier in the morning and reading to children. But back in the day when I was starting, I mean, it was San Francisco, so it was sort of a mix of both. The venues that I performed at tended to be a little more like arty, a little more almost like punk inspired, but very welcoming of a lot of different kinds of drag. Like there were always, you know, sort of like older glamorous or campy queens, as well as like, you know, monsters and I don't know, like people doing all sorts of things. And yeah, I've sort of just like stepped back a little bit from that. I don't know, as I got older with pandemic happening, as I've like, you know, become more professional in my day job, not in any like conscious way, but I keep kind of feeling like I've been saying this for a minute, but I feel like I'm on the cusp of some kind of performing renaissance, hopefully.
Interesting. I mean, West Hollywood, coming back to this exhibition, it doesn't feel super punky, arty, you know? So maybe you, as a curator for this exhibition, also had like some kind of like outside looking in view a little bit, like also maybe a little bit like a guest.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, I think probably many people, if you said West Hollywood drag to them now, they would think about some of these like bigger clubs, you know, like Mickey's or the Abbey, that, you know, that are legendary in their own right, but like are, I hate to say it, but like almost like a little more commercial or like touristy. You know, they tend to like book and feature queens who have been on RuPaul's Drag Race and things like that, you know, or there's like a number of brunches that are often for like bachelorette parties and things like that. And yeah, I don't want to deny or dismiss that form of drag. That's honestly how a lot of people make their living, and that's great. But I think in some ways, just given my own background and interests, yeah, my approach was to really think about drag in other forms, you know, in like you said, sort of like more punk alternative nightlife venues, but also like Halloween and pride parades and people putting on drag for the first time, and and you know, touring performers or productions that come through and things like that, and activist groups like the Imperial Court or the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. So, you know, I joke with a lot of my research that like mess is also part of my method, but I do think that part of it is about assembling a lot of these things and then, you know, trying to sort of share the breadth of the story in that way.
Oh, that makes sense. You mentioned drag time, story hour. Is it drag time story hour? No, it's
It's
like
just Drag Story Hour.
drag story hour. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Drag Story Hour, it's, you know, what it sounds like. It's drag performers reading books to kids in libraries and bookstores and schools and all sorts of community spaces. As a kind of organization and movement, it started in 2015 in San Francisco, by some friends of mine, Michelle T and Julian Delgado Lopera and Virgie Tovar. You know, kind of as this like crazy idea that just might work of recognizing the kinds of affinities that kids and drag performers have through, you know, notions of play, and yeah, kind of reinventing a traditional library story time. And so yeah, the idea quickly spread across the country and in some ways around the world. And so there's chapters all over now. I got involved kind of out of jealousy. I had just left San Francisco, like literally a few months before the first Drag Story Hour. And so on my social media, I started seeing, you know, pictures and videos of these events and just thought they were so adorable, but also powerful. and wanted to do it. And so I started doing it, I think, in 2016. And since then, I've been on the board I've kind of helped build it into a more formal network and organization, and I serve on the board now. And I've also published three children's books about drag performers as a way of kind of extending that work a little bit.
What are they
Yeah.
called?
The first is called The Hips on the Drag Queen Go Swish, Swish, Swish. The second is called If You're a Drag Queen and You Know It. And the third is called Make Your Own Rainbow, A Drag Queen's Guide to Color. And the
Oh, that's
first
cute.
four, thank you. Yeah, the first two are kind of like parodies of children's songs, making them about drag performers. The most recent one that just came out a couple of weeks ago is kind of teaching kids unconventional color names and encouraging them to kind of think beyond just the, primary and secondary colors of the rainbow.
It's interesting because when I try to find out a little bit about more like about your scholarship, like your scholarly work or like work as a professor, which you are also,
Which I am,
she's a professor.
yes.
I was quickly like the first or second things were like people harassing you for doing this children's this reading to children. Which I found super shocking, I have to say. I think, how do you deal with that situation? Like, it's like, I was like, oh my God, I don't know why.
Yeah, it's I mean it's not fun, although every now and then it does amuse me. I do I wear it as a badge of honor. I think that the fact that it ruffles feathers means that I and other people are doing something right. I think just that personally I've sort of been blessed with a thick skin, and I'm pretty good at not letting it get to me. And people say such ridiculous things. And I mean, I guess by ridiculous, I also mean, offensive, hateful, hurtful. But I think in some ways, because they're so extreme, there's no questioning like if it's true or, they don't. I don't hear them and think, oh, maybe I am harming children. They are just so absurd. And so I think it's easy for me to kind of just deflect them or pay them no mind. That's not to say that it's not hard. I mean, I've been harassed on my college campus. I've been called names literally by Congress people and our current Secretary of State. And thankfully no one has directly harmed me. But yeah, it's I mean it one of the worst things is the fact that when you search for me, these tend to be some of the first things that pop up. And so I think there is kind of a reputational impact around that. It is so absurd, and I think I'm certainly not the only drag performer who's dealt with it. I mean, part of my research now is kind of documenting this backlash and hatred that drag performers, especially in Drag Story Hour, but even beyond that, are dealing with, and trying to kind of theorize some of the more creative strategies that we have to counter it. It's also hard research to just, constantly be hearing stories about people being doxxed or threatened or, all sorts of things. When it's like we're just trying to to live our lives and read books to kids.
Yeah, and maybe show them, okay, there's a variety of things that exist in the world. Because as you said, like that rang very true to me when you said, like, oh, growing up, you thought drag was some kind of like straight entertainment, which I also thought. It's so I never thought about this. Just when you said this, I was like, yeah, I saw it on television, and I was always under the impression those are straight guys wearing a wig for fun. That's it. But to show also kids like there's a reality behind this and a culture behind this, and you can be this and this and this and this and this. Of course, it's not to say like you have to, it's not a course in being a drag queen, no? Like, I suppose. It could
And
be,
like it could
but.
be. Yeah. I mean, it is funny. In some of my first story hours, like I would have kids say, like I sort of jokingly be like, repeat after me. When I grow up, I want to be a drag queen, you know? And to me, that was sort of poking fun at these ideas that that would be such a horrible thing to say, you know? And that kids and drag queens shouldn't be near each other. And I guess at the time I was maybe a little bit naive about what it would mean to say that kind of thing and for the right wing to hear it and pick up on it. One of the things that is so odd right now is that it's because of these kinds of attacks from the right, I just feel like it's sucked all the nuance out of the room. And I guess I am grateful that in some of my academic work, I'm able to kind of explore a little bit of that more. But yeah, like there's just all these interesting factors at play where on the one hand, I think some people think we are or want us to be like mainstreaming drag, right? To like make it appropriate for children and make it into this thing that like, I don't know, is becomes the equivalent of like being a clown at a children's birthday party or something. And no offense to clowns, but like that's not what I'm trying to be. I do think that drag kind of inherently is subversive in some way, right? Like it is about a spirit of queer play. It is about challenging, the status quo and different kinds of social norms. It is about a sort of unabashed creative expression and all these sorts of things. And so, yeah, like I don't want it to become fully mainstream. And at the same time, I have to kind of defend it as something that can, with the right intentions and under the right circumstances, be appropriate for children because it is reflective of the world that we live in, and because of course we're not, doing harmful things. And kind of similarly, even, with all these accusations of like we're indoctrinating children, my kind of common response is like we're not indoctrinating, we're encouraging them to use their imaginations. And I do stand behind that. And I'm also like, I don't know. So what if we're indoctrinating children? Or like if we're indoctrinating them into a worldview that's about love and creativity and acceptance and being your most fabulous self and treating others with kindness, like so what? Like the alternative that the right is offering is an indoctrination of hatred and fear and fascism, and like that's the true indoctrination. So it's, yeah, it's just so absurd to me that we're kind of they've been able to control the narrative in a way that we're always kind of like defending ourselves rather than actually kind of imagining what drag is and can be.
Yeah. And also, I mean, no kid becomes queer or gay or lesbian or a drag queen just by shouting, I want to be a drag queen when I grow up.
Right.
I mean,
Totally.
if it was that easy, it's like it's just opening up, possibilities or something like, or maybe building compassion or putting yourself in a place of imagining it for a second, but it doesn't turn you whatever. But does it have become worse since the recent political developments here in the US? Do you feel like a difference or?
Yes and no. I mean, I'd say over the almost 10 years that this program has existed, it's definitely intensified. I think the first few drag story hours, I think, kind of flew under the radar. But I think, pretty early on, it started to catch the attention of various forms of conservatives. But for, the first, I don't know, 5 or so years, the opposition we faced tended to be like small, quiet, almost like respectful protests, like it was kind of like nice church ladies who didn't agree and were just gonna kind of like stand out there with their signs. And then I think it was maybe 2022, so yeah, like 3 years ago, that's when, quite literal fascist, neo-Nazi groups, white supremacist groups like the Proud Boys and others started showing up to events and kind of really directly threatening and threatening violence towards performers and attendees. And that's when we also started to see legislative attacks on the state level. So trying to, in some ways, ban drag story hours or drag events for children outright or defund them. In a few cases, the legislation proposed would actually criminalize drag performers who perform for children and add them to like sex offender registries. So that was kind of like, I would say, the real intensification. I feel like I'm holding my breath right now because there's so much going on in this country politically that is truly terrible, that I think in some ways the heat has been taken off of us. And I don't know if that's temporary or if that's lasting. And I don't think it's, I mean, it might be good for us in the short term, but I don't think it's because things have fundamentally changed. I think it just means that someone else is the target right now. I had the incident where Marjorie Taylor Greene held up this blown up photo of me where she, called me a predator and a monster and argued for defunding public radio and public television because I had read my book on this very small locally produced program. And President Trump cited that in his executive order trying to defund these agencies, and also cited drag performers in his order restructuring the Kennedy Center for the Arts. So it's like we're still in the mix. But I would also say, thankfully, after the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing, I received almost no hate mail or almost no kind of like backlash from her followers, which makes me feel like, yeah, their attention is somewhere else, and it's sort of hard to know what that means. In 2014, so yeah, a little over 10 years ago, I just personally, I had just finished a Master's of Fine Arts in Digital Art and Technology, where I was kind of trying to take some of the sensibilities that I, was working with in drag performance and kind of, I don't know, rethink them or transform them into more of a visual arts practice. And I was making, kind of like site-specific installations about things like the Google buses and gentrification in San Francisco. And right as I was finishing that program, a bunch of drag performers found ourselves either locked out of Facebook, which was kind of, it's funny to think, but was the dominant social media platform at the time, or forced to use our legal names in order to regain access. And in some cases, people were, gave their legal name thinking that it was kind of just like a back end thing, and then suddenly saw it on the front end and kind of felt like they were outed by that. And so, being good drag performers, we decided to not take that lying down, and we organized and protested, and founded this hashtag My Name Is campaign and brought in other marginalized groups that had been impacted by this quote unquote real names policy. And so I think, yeah, in some ways that was a formative kind of activist moment for me. But one that I was really deeply ambivalent about, in that I wanted to get people access to this platform that was so influential at the time, and for them to be able to express themselves in sort of whatever way felt most authentic or, gave them the most privacy. And at the same time, I was also like, why are we getting people back on Facebook? Like, it's a garbage platform that's sucking up all of our data and, doing countless nefarious things. And this was even before, like, Cambridge Analytica and like a lot of the kind of more public scandals about it. And kind of around the same time, I had noticed this trend where Facebook had, like, I guess probably recently rolled out its facial recognition algorithms. And so it was doing things like, suggesting tags of different friends when you uploaded photos. And drag performers started posting screenshots where the facial recognition algorithms were confusing them with other people. So, like, either tagging them as someone else or incorrectly tagging someone else as them. And often it was in this, like, very playful, like, haha, like, look how wrong this is, or like, look who the algorithm thinks you are, kind of things. And that just sort of got me thinking, like, as much as we're kind of demanding access to these platforms, the both the spirit, but again, kind of like the material realities of drag also lend themselves to kind of evading some of these forms of detection and data collection. And that to me felt like something that I wanted to explore further. And so I decided to do a PhD, and that has kind of, yeah, become the foundation of my research of like of thinking about, to say it kind of cheekily, like if we think like a drag queen, how does that open up new forms of counter surveillance or countering various harms of digital technology? And so yeah, in some ways the project kind of started narrowly by thinking about these different forms of surveillance, but now I'm also thinking again about how drag performers counter various forms of hate speech and harassment, both online and off, and also how, how drag kind of might help us think differently about things like AI and generative AI. And I should say, as part of my academic work, I'm writing a book on this. And so one of my chapters, it's kind of like based on some experiments I was doing a couple of years ago, asking or using generative AI to create images of drag performers. And I'm very critical of AI for a lot of reasons. And I was kind of surprised at myself how resonant the images felt and how connected to them I felt. And I guess with that, I'm sort of trying to unpack, like, yeah, what that means. And
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, even the word alone, artificial or artifice or something, is something that totally resonates with something like drag, to create a persona
yeah, that's
who
literally
doesn't
what it
exist in reality somehow.
is. Right.
That's super interesting.
Thank
And
you.
also this like facial recognition thing, like evade this thing through like contouring.
Right,
Because
exactly.
the drag makeup is so advanced that it really, I also never thought about this,
Yeah.
that it totally, it even changes your bone structure somehow,
Right, right.
So the camera probably thinks, yeah, you are somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and you will publish this as a book sometimes, or how far are you in the process of this?
No comment on that, but yeah,
Okay, that's the wrong. Yeah, that's all
hopefully
the
in the
don't
next
ask
year.
academics, like, when is the book coming out? When
Right,
are you
no,
finished? I'm sorry.
it's
I should have known.